Hello, and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the Deals podcast where we sit down with private equity and venture capital practitioners and talk about their deals and deal making. I'm your host, Chris Nolter, TMT reporter for The Deal. Let's welcome Jeremy Shine, partner at Corsair Capital. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Jeremy, you're head of North American buyouts at Corsair, and your coverage area ranges from payments, insurance, and fintechs to identity security and fraud. So that's a really fascinating kind of range of things. And one of your investments is Aurora Payments, which has acquired a few businesses this year, like Nailsoft and VN Systems. And I thought it might be interesting to start with payments and your kind of view of what's happening in that sector.
Yeah, sure. So Corsair's been around since 1992. We focus on really the areas of business services, software, and payments in and around financial services. We target middle market companies, both in North America and Europe. And one of the areas where we've had success and continue to look for deals and are excited about the future is payments. And we have a few payments assets today. Aurora is an interesting one that you brought up. From our perspective, the merchant acquiring in the payment space is a large and still fragmented space. In 2022, there was about $33 billion of revenue off of over $11.5 trillion of volume. And between 2016 and 2019, those volumes continued to grow at around 7% and will probably grow at another 6% in 2023. And beyond the top 15 players in the space, there's no one that has more than 1.7% market share. So a very fragmented area. That's on the consumer side, which is where Aurora plays. What we think is a really interesting theme there is that there is this convergence of software and payments. Aurora is a business that came at from the payment side. And part of our thesis was to consolidate assets, both around distributions, but then also around software. And Nailsoft is one that you mentioned, which was a funny niche area that I hadn't really thought about before in my life, which is the nail salon industry. And the nail salon industry in this country is a large industry. It's very, very fragmented. And historically, it's been a pretty heavily cash business. So we found a business that we bought that was founded by a Vietnamese entrepreneur who really understood the nuances of the nail salon industry. He had friends and family members who had owned nail salons, and he understood the problems that they faced, which were everything from booking and scheduling to how you collect money, how you tip, even how you collect customer information and how you share that with your other nail technicians. So he had built a platform, which was a good product, but didn't have the distribution and the scale that he needed to survive on his own, particularly as some of the clouds around software valuations and, you know, higher interest rates started to come into effect in the last couple of years. So we were able to acquire that and put it onto the platform. And the thing that's nice about it, and the thing that was interesting to us as well, was that although it's focused on nail salons, there are a lot of other applications as well, which over time, we think we can use that same software to develop opportunities. So think about businesses that have scheduling, that have tipping, that may or may not be renting out locations within their broader space. You know, think about pet grooming, think about broader beauty care. All of those sorts of businesses, we think we can continue to develop software off of this Nailsoft platform. And then the great part about it is once you have these platforms and these products, you're able to create a much stickier customer base. You know, I think where payments needs to go is you need to be adding value to your customer in order to help them grow their business. You can't just be the guy or gal collecting the cash for them and putting in the bank account. That part of the business is getting much more commoditized. and is why we're very focused on this integration of software into the payment space.
That's really interesting. So payments needs to be more than just the mechanism for facilitating transactions. So what about B2B? How does that compare to consumer payments?
So B2B payments, we actually think is one of, if not the most areas of investment today. We have one platform that we've invested in, which is a company called TreviPay, where it was a carve out from a public company that we did right in the height of COVID. And in terms of where that market is headed, B2B payments is about as large and underpenetrated as a market as I've seen. There's about $125 trillion US TAM. And that ranges from traditional corporate cards and virtual cards to cross-border B2B. Think about how companies pay each other across continents using bank accounts that may or may not have to deal with the FX exchange, and then accounts payable and accounts receivable collection. Incredibly, and this may not be that surprising to some of the listeners or to you, Chris, 42% of B2B payments volumes are still actually executed with paper checks today and have antiquated invoices, sometimes handwritten. Sometimes they make it into the proper Excel file. Sometimes they don't, which is why there's such an important and interesting opportunity there. And a lot of that got accelerated during COVID when some of the individuals who may have done the accounts receivable or accounts payable realized they didn't have access to that information while they were sent home. And there was a rush to sort of think about the technology solutions that would allow you to continue to collect money and service your clients during the pandemic. But those trends have continued, and we're really excited about that.
Wow, 42%, that does surprise me. I would have thought it would be lower, considering how much tech seems to be targeted towards payments. So we've discussed a few of your investments, and the Coursera website tells us that the target enterprise value is about $150 million to $750 million. But is there anything else you can tell us about the parameters, whether it's quantitative or qualitative, about what makes a Coursera investment?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question because it's something that I personally think about at night, because it's not that hard simply to put money out the door. You really have to think about why did you win, and making sure that you have parameters in place and stick to those are really important. So we focus on targeting proven and durable business models where they have a clear market position and large TAMs, so target addressable markets that they can continue to grow into over time. Innovation is important. We're not investing on the very sort of edge of where venture capital is, but there needs to be a focus on innovation and an understanding of technology. There needs to be, and this is really important, strong management teams that want to partner and are looking for more than just capital, but looking for thought partners to help get to better decisions over time collectively. There needs to be growing customer bases with recurring revenues where we don't see large single client risk. And then we're looking for strong organic growth. And frequently, we are seeing more and more opportunities to grow through M&A, where if you have the right platform and the right management team, you can really differentiate your value.
That's interesting. Now, Oakbridge is one that involved a bit of M&A, but unlike some of the investments we've spoken about so far, that was not a fintech, right? That was kind of a traditional insurance investment. Could you maybe tell us about that?
Yeah. So Oakbridge was an insurance broker that we invested in at the very end of 2020. And at the time, they were four separate and independent insurance brokers that were largely focused in Georgia, but had presence in four states in and around the Southeast. Over the course of 3 years, we tripled the revenue of the business and tripled the EBITDA of the business while doubling the number of employees. What was interesting about the way that we did that was, first of all, we brought in what we believed was an incredibly high-performing management team that we knew we could partner with. And not only that, we thought would be able to be a good partner to the insurance brokers and these entrepreneurs that we were looking to acquire. And that's easier said than done. So finding the right individual and the right talent at the top was critical. We then really focused on building what we called the One Oak Bridge solution. So some PE firms and some PE roll-up strategies are really focused on acquisitions. No matter what, if you can buy something cheap, you put it on the books and you shake it all up. And at the end of the day, you hope you have something that works. We were really focused on finding platforms that wanted to be part of our broader Oak Bridge strategy and create what we called One Oak Bridge. So that was creating central insurance functions, taking over their HR, bringing in their finance function, building workflow management, helping them with training, licensing, carrier marketing, and really also helping them to cross-sell into their customer bases. So it ended up being a fantastic outcome. We were able to complete 28 acquisitions in less than 3 years. And although we had originally expected to hold it for longer, we were ahead of our plan and exited the investment just in the fourth quarter of this past year at a really great outcome and are really excited about the future for Oak Bridge as well.
Wow, 28 acquisitions. That's a big number. That's an interesting point that you exited sooner than you expected. Seems like I'm seeing more long holds, longer hold periods. Is that against trend?
That's a great point. And you look across the portfolios of the private equity industry, you know, around 25% of sponsor portfolio companies have been held for 6 or more years today. And approximately 50% have been held for more than 4 years. So the good news on that is I think we're getting to the point where even with what was some dislocation in value in the past year or so, we're going to be at a point where private equity firms need to continue to advance the ball and dispose of some of these assets that have been in their portfolio for a while. One of the things that we found, which is really critical, though, is you may not be able to pinpoint whether your investment's going to be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years, but focusing on value creation to generate alpha is really, really important in this market. You cannot just rely on buying well enough and selling well enough to the next buyer, which frankly, there was a lot of that that took place in the free money environment that we all lived in for longer than I think any of us recognized at the time. So what we've done is we've really focused on a value creation playbook. And we have operating partners that help us focus on talent, go-to-market, technology, and M&A. And other private equity firms talk about that. Some do it as well. We've really been, we think, at the forefront of that by bringing that in-house in a portfolio consulting group and creating an institutionalized model with playbooks of how to be partners with our management team to help make decisions faster and more effectively. Because in the more complicated markets, that's going to be a big part of getting it right. So hiring individuals as quickly as you can, if you have an opportunity, if you have an opportunity to upgrade talent, making that decision, because most decisions around upgrades or removing an individual from a management team happen too long because people like them. They're part of your family. Helping build out product and innovation teams, making sure go-to-market motion is running effectively and efficiently, and going and looking at M&A, where many of our companies, because they are middle market, haven't had full-blown M&A platforms and haven't built the M&A muscle that they need to go and be effective acquirers over time.
That's interesting. And what about partnerships with portfolio companies? Is that part of the plan as well?
Yeah, we back our management teams when we are making an investment. And that's a big part of what our operating partners help us do, is we are looking to assess our management teams and figure out if we can go to battle with these guys for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And they don't have to be your best friends, but I talk to my CEOs at least once a week, frequently more than that. We're communicating on meetings and strategy, and they know when my dog has stomach issues because I'm walking around the block with them and talking to my dog while I'm talking to them. I mean, if you don't get to know your teams really well, if you don't know what they're going through, make them part of your broader family, you're really missing it, because you're going to have hard decisions to make together, and you need to develop that trust. And that's really important to us, and why we've brought on a human capital operating partner in Mike Fontana, who's worked with us and continues to work with us across our entire portfolio.
That's interesting. I mean, human capital management is such a higher priority across just so many businesses now, with competition for skills, all kinds of skills. And I guess it makes sense that it would be for skills at portfolio companies too. So when you're working with the operating partners in about M&A, do you have a sense going into an investment whether this is a platform for M&A, or is that something that the operating partners and you and the portfolio company come up with over time as you work together?
That's a great question. I would tell you that historically what we've done is we've built organic cases that are generally less reliant on M&A, but have focused on then assessing how likely or unlikely M&A is going to play into that investment thesis. So something like Oak Bridge, we completely knew it was going to be an M&A platform. So all of that was about how quickly you can buy good things, identify good things, and create a flywheel of M&A with organic growth. Other businesses like TreviPay, we underwrote that without really thinking that there would be much M&A. There's been some M&A. That's one of those areas when B2B payments, it's super exciting, very interesting. Lots of people want to get into the space, but it's been hard to find the right M&A opportunities there, particularly as, you know, in the current deal environment, which, you know, you still have these pretty wide bid-ask spreads that have made it a little bit tougher. But we underwrote that deal without needing M&A to make our investment thesis work.
So the days of free money are gone, and sponsors really have to, you know, improve and build the portfolio companies to really get the returns they want. Like, do you think M&A will be more a part of the playbook?
I mean, look, that cuts both ways there, because the elevated rate environment has certainly influenced all PE activity, and that includes internal M&A. So, you know, blended rates have surged, as we know, as base rates have gone up and widening spreads on new issuances are up significantly as well. Financing markets, actually, while being volatile, can be quite constructive, but then there's a little blip in the system and that goes away, and there's less constructive conversations for a week or two. So there's a lot more volatility there. You've seen multiples trade down now, but depending on the week, they're actually pretty close to, if not above, pre-COVID levels. And, you know, obviously that fluctuates depending on what day you're actually listening to this conversation. But that being said, premium assets continue to fetch premium prices. So all of that goes to say that M&A is harder in this market than it was in the free money environment. But if you get it right, it can be very successful. Getting scale matters a lot, and creating premium assets generates a lot of value.
Yeah. See what you mean about how it cuts both ways. Another question that I'm asking people these days is what impact they think an election year will have on deal flow, and not commenting on any outcome of the election, yeah. But often I hear that there's an election year hangover where uncertainty can make it more complicated to strike yeah. deals.
I mean, Chris, you're definitely hitting at the probably the trillion-dollar question right now. As you know, typically going into an election year, you haven't had this level of subdued M&A that you do right now. Many deal processes have been deferred or canceled because of macro uncertainties and complications around debt. So it's interesting, when we've been looking through our pipeline, we feel good about our pipeline. A lot of deals, though, that we expected to see or be able to have conversations around in Q3 of this year got bumped to Q4 and are now sort of pushing towards next year. But you're right, next year, once you get past Q1, people are going to be talking a lot about the elections, and the markets typically don't love uncertainty. So it depends a lot on where you're looking at. If you're thinking about making an investment where there's some regulatory exposure or some exposure to a geography that could have pretty different impacts depending on who's in power, it's going to be pretty hard to get those deals off next year. That being said, lots of people are waiting very patiently to get deals done right now. And you've got to think that that pent-up demand will push people to be pretty aggressive. You could also see a big sprint towards the end of the year, but if I were to guess, I would say once you hit Q3, things are going to be kind of quiet as people are trying to figure out and make heads or tails on what the political tea leaves are telling them.
Interesting. Yeah, it certainly has been subdued. And we do have this big question mark next year with the elections. How has the market reset since COVID?
What you had seen in the post-COVID low interest rate environment was really a trend towards growth at all costs. And as rates have come up, we see more of a growth at a reasonable cost approach. So make sure you're favoring efficiency. The interest rates created a lot of cash pressures for portfolio companies and for industries, and have forced people to really focus on profitability again, which is good. And I do think that there will also be opportunities for some private equity portfolio companies to become acquirers of some earlier stage venture capital backed businesses that may be able to contribute product or distribution or technology or something else. And I think that could also create some pretty interesting outcomes.
That's interesting. Is there a reason why that would be more venture stage companies?
The point there being more companies that had been burning cash have done a very good job, or many of them have done a good job of surviving by cutting costs, by hoarding cash, by getting their earlier rounds done, or by doing inside rounds. But as time goes by, and if there isn't sort of a reopening of the floodgates for the non-profitable but growing piece of the private market, I think you could see strategic interest from private equity and from publics to acquire some of those businesses where there may not have been in the past, because those may be the right homes.
In the deals that you look at, do you often see competition from public companies?
That's a great question, Chris. And it literally changes month to month. It has a lot to do with stock prices. It has a lot to do with where companies who might be competing are in terms of their board calendars. And, you know, it was a very different answer a year and a half ago than it was today. I do think that we're going to get back to a place where public companies are significant acquirers again, because it's a great way to continue to fuel growth.
You know, in the large cap PE deals, we've seen strategics buying larger multi-billion dollar software companies. And then you see Cisco buying Splunk, which raises the question of, is strategic M&A back? And I was just curious how that filtered into kind of the middle market where you're really involved.
Yeah, it's a great, again, great question. It feels like there have been a bunch of those moments in the last 12 months where you've seen a deal happen and all of a sudden there's been a big question of M&A is back. Are we going to start seeing lots of Monday morning announcements? And it hasn't happened that way yet, which I think to some extent goes to a real focus on quality and super high conviction M&A versus deal fever. So I do think it will come back. One thing that I talk about with my team a lot is that there really is no easy market. If you sort of look back across my career, and I've done this for over 22 years, every time's always a little bit scary. So, you know, it's very easy to look back and it seems like people forget that investing at the end of 2020, when everyone was doing all of those deals in the end, many of which have worked out well, was really scary at the time. But with hindsight, you look back and said, oh, it was so obvious that we could lock in our interest rates and take money here and put money there. And that's frequently the case. So I'm optimistic long term that private equity will, and particularly middle market, where we think we can really spend the time and add value by doing these value creation activities and working with our operating partners and working really closely with their broader management teams, we really have an opportunity to generate a significant amount of value. And there will be months where it feels like the world's falling apart and we'll never find that next deal. And then we'll get over that and we'll find a whole bunch of deals. And there are months where you feel like you have too many deals and you don't know what to do with them all. But that all levels out. And I think there's a lot of excitement here about finding great opportunities and working with our portfolio companies to generate value for our shareholders.
Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Really enjoyed it. Hope we can speak again sometime soon.
Thanks so much. This is Chris Nolter, TMT reporter for The Deal. Thanks for joining us for Behind the Buyouts.